Welcome to Oncology Today, optimizing the management of endocrine-resistant, hormone-receptor-positive metastatic breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Hope Rugo from the City of Hope Comprehensive Cancer Center in Duarte, California. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Rugo's slide presentation. To begin, I asked her to discuss the drug-to-antibody ratio of available antibody-drug conjugates and what implications they have for efficacy and toxicity.
We don't really know how the drug-to-antibody ratio affects the toxicity or efficacy because the majority, you know, two out of three of them have a drug-to-antibody ratio between 7.5 to 8. And so we're not really understanding what that relationship is to efficacy or toxicity. You know, we have a lower DAR with Dato-DXd, but seeing a new toxicity of stomatitis. And even if you're targeting TROP2 with SG, you don't see stomatitis. And if you use deruxtecan with T-DXd, you don't see stomatitis. So, you know, I would have thought that that would be a big indicator with toxicity, but it hasn't panned out. And I don't think we know enough yet to say what the difference is in efficacy. I will say that maybe with deruxtecan, seeing less of an ILD rate with Dato-DXd is related to the lower DAR, but it also could just be related to the fact that you're not targeting HER2.
Well, if I saw that correctly, it kind of surprised me because I always thought like one of the reasons that T-DXd was so effective was the DAR, you know, being, I guess, you know, high or what, 8 or whatever. But I think your graphic was the same thing for sacituzumab. Am I right?
Yeah, it's very similar. But remember, you're using a different target antibody and a different toxin.
Right.
Right. So targeting TROP2, the hazard ratios are very similar across Dato and SG for the PFS. So, you know, you're targeting TROP2, you're getting a different effect than targeting HER2 for reasons that aren't really clear. And maybe the differential with Dato and T-DXd is also related to the DAR, but I suspect because of what we've seen with SG, highly effective, but with, you know, a sort of looks like the second treatment for HR-positive disease overall after T-DXd that are HER2 low, you know, you can't really pull the DAR into that.
So another term that I noticed you talking about, again, I've heard this before, but I just wanted to bring it back up, was linker drug instability, which, again, I always thought was an advantage of T-DXd, but now after you were talking about it, I wasn't exactly sure. I mean, I thought it was like, you know, the bystander, that was a good thing, but then, of course, you can get more toxicity. Again, can you explain what the linker drug instability, what it is exactly, what's the difference and what it means?
I would say that if I go from back to, you know, like forward to back, we don't understand what it means to have linker drug instability, except for that you release free drug into the circulation and you still seem to be having efficacy with these drugs, right? The efficacy is similar, but you may in certain situations have more toxicity. So is the linker drug instability, for example, for SG, a cause for it's both its efficacy because you're releasing drug on the cell surface, so you're targeting even more cells around it, but also a reason for the bone marrow suppression that we see with SG? Could that be what's caused here, you know, causing the issue here?
So another, you know, kind of conceptual thing that I saw there that I thought was interesting, like in terms of ADCs, was the data you showed that Aditi Abardia presented at ASCO, looking at time on CDK and effects of T-DXd and HER2 low. And it was interesting because he and others had, you probably were involved with it too, had looked at time on CDK in terms of benefit of SERDs, where they saw greater benefit in patients who had been on more than a year. And here he showed in the other group, the short relapsers, they had more benefit from T-DXd. So again, what do you think the biology is in terms of why it looks like T-DXd works better in those patients?
Oh, because I think those patients have endocrine refractory disease. And, you know, if you give a better chemo, it works better because they need chemo. And they have, you know, because these patients who have very resistant disease, they tend to have short time on each sequential chemotherapy also. So we know that TDXD, SG, these are better ways of delivering toxins, cytotoxic agents, to the cancer cell. So if you have a better drug, it's going to work a lot better in people who have very resistant disease.
Yeah, I mean, intuitively kind of seems that way, but I don't know if there's any biology. Like, is it a great, well, you see higher Ki-67 or something?
Well, not necessarily. And, you know, Ki-67 isn't really used in the advanced setting because it can vary a lot between different organs and you're not getting serial biopsies. Right. So, you know, are they more sensitive? So it's not that TDXD works better in that population. It's that TDXD works remarkably better than our other options in that situation.
Right.
Right? But in the situation of slower growing, more sensitive disease, the differential benefit is going to be narrower, because all chemo will work. You know, you give these patients, you know, paclitaxel in the fifth line setting and they can respond.
Yeah, another question about HER2 low and ER positive disease is, how do you decide what comes first in patients who are HER2 low or ultra low, TDXD or capecitabine?
Yes, and that's a big question, I think, for all of us. And how low can you go where you're going to give TDXD versus SG? And I think, or Dato, and, you know, you have to decide what you're going to give. And, you know, for me, it's more if patients have indolent, slowly progressive disease, not very symptomatic, mostly, you know, bone dominant, I'm going to give them capecitabine, an oral drug. They can travel. They don't have the risk of ILD. The frequency of scans can be less. That's a real advantage to our patients. But for patients who have more, you know, liver dominant disease or are highly symptomatic, short of breath, et cetera, in that situation, I'm going to give TDXC.
So I'll ask you the question I've been asking of other people. Are there situations where you have used or would like to use TDXD, ultra low, ER negative, or triple negative?
You know, right now, our approved drug with level one evidence in triple negative patients is sacituzumab govitecan. So I use that first. If a patient had a little HER2, and, you know, you go to the pathologist and it's like 8%, and you've now given your SG and another treatment, maybe a taxane or gemcarbo, I would try TDXD in that situation. I think that, you know, these patients have such a short survival and limited treatment options. I don't see how, if you could get it, why you wouldn't try it, but I wouldn't do it up front.
So you mentioned your strategy in triple negative disease. What about sequencing for clinical, you know, purposes in ER positive disease after endocrine therapy, patients who are HER2 low, HER2 ultra low, HER2 zero, you got TDXD, Dato, and sacituzumab. How do you decide, how do you sequence these? And any thoughts about these trials that you talked about? They're going to look at sequencing. You think that's going to give us useful information?
You know, I hope that it does give us useful information. The randomized TRAID-DXT trial, of course, is looking at Dato and TDXT. So we'll have information on that. The question is whether or not we really know the variables that are important in terms of understanding response. And I think that remains to be seen. And also, there will be a lot of work going on looking at mechanisms of resistance, which I think is also particularly important in this population as we think about it. But what in clinical practice, you know, we tend in a patient who clearly has HER2 low disease or, you know, a reasonable amount of HER2 ultra low, we've been giving TDXD first because of its remarkable outcomes and also the fact that, you know, there's less hair loss, which matters a lot to our patients, and less bone marrow suppression. But I will say if a patient had prior symptomatic ILD on another drug, you know, risky, needed a lot of steroids, treated for a long time, I would consider using SG first because, you know, the risk of ILD is, you know, there, and there is mortality and people have to discontinue if they have symptomatic ILD. In a French retrospective real-world study, they found that the odds ratio if you had prior ILD for getting ILD with TDXD was around 3.4. So, you know, more than a threefold increase risk. So I do think you have to be cautious. In the right setting, you know, you just need to monitor really closely and get that first CT scan at 6 weeks. Make sure you're capturing the early risks, you know, patient population, which I think is particularly critical. And so then how do we decide, you know, with a patient who has ER positive disease, but HER2 zero? So you got this patient's HER2 zero, you go to your pathologist and they say, you know, we see one cell in 1,000. You really have to individualize for the patient. How rapidly do they need a response and what's their ER? Because in some of those patients, I found that the ER now has gone from like 80% to 5%. And I'm going to be thinking of treating those patients who have almost no HER2 potentially with TROP2 ADC first. So I do think for each patient, you just have to individualize based on all of these different biologic characteristics that we're seeing with patients. And there just isn't a cookbook approach, except for the overall, which is, you know, triple negative, I use SG first, and for HR positive, HER2 low, clearly ultra low and not like close to zero, we tend to give TDXT first.
So a few questions on some comments you made about toxicity of ADCs. First of all, the issue of olanzapine in terms of delayed nausea and vomiting with TDXT. You know, it's kind of interesting as we've seen, TDXT go outside of breast cancer, you know, into, gynecologic cancers and GU cancers, et cetera. There's not as much awareness, I think, of the GI toxicity of TDXT. And I bring up olanzapine, and a lot of them kind of haven't sort of thought about that. Could you talk a little bit more about what you saw before we started, or what was seen before we started to use olanzapine, and how olanzapine helps? Do you need it for everybody? Do you use it in it, or you wait and see whether they have a problem?
So for TDX, you know, it's interesting. So sacituzumab causes nausea, but it's sort of moderate nausea. You give a 3-drug regimen, a little regular rescue, they're fine in a couple of days. For TDXD and for Dato in our limited experience, you know, with Dato to date, because we haven't given it to massive numbers of patients, but we did give 4 doses in the I-SPY trial. So I have that experience in an untreated population as well. But I have found the best approach is to hand everybody olanzapine when they start and to tell them to take olanzapine the first night through 3 to 5 days. And then the other thing you have to tell people, because a lot of people are really sticklers for detail, is that if they're still nauseated, they should keep taking the drug. So people will say to me, boy, you know, I felt okay the first 5 days and then I got really nauseated. I'm like, okay, well, don't stop the olanzapine. And some patients that I had took it the whole time. It also helped them sleep, so they like that. You know, some people say, oh, it makes me sleepy. I tell them, take a half a pill. Your body will adjust to it and you'll be okay. You know, the dose that was studied initially was 10 milligrams, then 5. Then we have this nice randomized trial from India, from Mumbai, looking at 2.5 versus the higher dose. And people had much less somnolence and it worked just as well.
So incidentally, speaking of, TDXT or drugs outside of breast cancer for non-breast cancer people, I have to give you some follow-up on the last session we did together, which was some content for the AUA meeting, Urologic Association, because they're looking maybe at CAPI. We're waiting to see the trial, but there's a press release saying capivasertib is going to be useful in prostate. And I've got to tell you again, totally spellbound audience listening to this is urologists listening to you talk about CAPI and diabetes. It was like, and they were like, wow, you know. So we'll see whether that ends up in the prostate. They've got enough to deal with right now in prostate, but I think it's going to be interesting if some of these targeted therapies come in. So another question about toxicity was you were showing some data with sacituzumab on preemptive management of diarrhea, neutropenia with loperamide and growth factors. Can you talk a little bit more about it and sort of to what extent, if any, you know, do you do that in your practice? How do you evaluate for that in a patient about to begin sacituzumab?
Yeah, I mean, I think the PRIME study was really helpful and it just shows the value of using medications to control symptoms. But what we do in clinical practice is, you know, we give the drug, we tell people about the risk of diarrhea. I make sure that nobody gets an infusion without having loperamide in their pocket. You know, what the worst thing is, you give a drug to a patient, whether it's abemaciclib or capivasertib or sacituzumab, and they go home and they have diarrhea in the middle of the night, or they go to work the next day and they don't have it. So it does turn out you really have to make sure that you educate patients with having these drugs available to them before they start their treatment. It is really critical because who's going to Walgreens in the middle of the night to get your loperamide while you're having, you know, uncontrollable diarrhea. So this is no good. So then I tell people, you know, we give them a recommendation for how to take the drug. And the other thing I think that's really important is for patients to call into the healthcare center. They want to call in and get advice, because I often find that people will think the diarrhea is going to go away, and then they don't take the medications because they're afraid of constipation. So we really want to try and have people call into the healthcare center. You can't, like abemaciclib, you can have them hold the drug, but you've given your IV treatment, so you can't. So have them call in, get management help from the team that you have educated about how to manage this. And then when you get over the acute event, it's helping people understand how to prophylax, because then you want to prevent. So are you going to take a loperamide every day for the first 5 days? Are you going to take a half a pill every day or an every other day dose? There are a lot of ways to manage this to try and prevent the diarrhea. And if the diarrhea persists, dose reduce, because you can always go back up again once you've controlled the diarrhea. So that's the first symptom. The neutropenia, you know, as we move SG earlier in the line of therapy in the metastatic setting and give it as post-neoadjuvant therapy for triple negative disease, you know, I've just seen a lot less severe neutropenia. I don't really see febrile neutropenia much at all. So what I do is, in people who needed growth factor for their last treatment, I give growth factor up front, a single dose on day 3 and then day 10. You know, if that's if they can get it at home, it helps a lot. Whatever's convenient, even if they have to come in for it with Medicare, it's easier to skip a day. Then if patients have persistent neutropenia, we will escalate it. And if they need more than a dose or two, I generally will give pegfilgrastim after day 8 and no short-acting growth factor at all. A lot of times you have to get through one cycle where you give short-acting after day one, you know, the day one. But after that, we don't need to. And it's incredibly well-tolerated for patients, whether you give it as an injection or an on-body device.
One more toxicity question. You referred, you know, you talked a lot about mucositis with Dato, and you referred to ocular, but can you talk a little bit more about your experience with Dato in terms of ocular issues, like when it occurs, what happens, how do you look in, you know, is how much of an issue it is?
Most of the events are low grade, so it's really dry eye, but, you know, as someone with dry eye that's associated with looking at a computer screen a lot in age, it is quite irritating to have really dry eyes. So what's recommended with Dato is that you tell patients to use these preservative-free eye drops starting right away when they start their infusions. And I think that that can work really well. I never had a patient who had to stop Dato because of eye toxicity. But if a patient has developed symptoms, it's really important to work with an ophthalmologist, because sometimes if you have inflammation, a short course of these low-potency steroid eye drops makes a really big difference. You don't want to use your regular steroid eye drops, and you don't want to give them for a long time because they increase the risk of cataracts. But I think that you really can manage this with Dato for most patients really well. If a patient has ongoing eye problems before you start, it's prudent to get an eye exam before you give the first dose. And then if a patient gets dry eyes, of course, one thing you can do is to have them use the more potent eye drops that are used for dry eye that are on the market. They just have to be preservative free.
So two more questions. These are sort of outside of ER positive, but conceptually important and certainly clinically important. Also curious, how do you think it'll affect sequencing? So first question is about ASCENT-04, KEYNOTE-D19, the use of sacituzumab first line triple negative disease. What's your take on that data and how it's going to affect practice? And also, I guess, the companion trial that's looking with PD-1 negative patients.
Yeah, so very excited to see that first press release with ASCENT-04, because we had seen two phase 2 trials, one with SG, one with Dato, combined with immunotherapy, that showed remarkable response rates and PFS rates of a year or more. And we saw the same data in this phase 3 trial, really exciting PD-L1 positive disease. We can't separate out the benefit of the checkpoint inhibitor here, but because we had a trial already, KEYNOTE-355, showing improved overall survival in a patient population with the worst survival in metastatic breast cancer, I think that it's really reasonable and important to continue the checkpoint inhibitor based on preclinical data. I think in the US, many people will take this data and move forward with it very quickly. One question that has come up is what happens if people have received a checkpoint inhibitor in the early stage setting because only 4% of patients had an ASCENT-04. And I think that for most of us, we would give the Pembro anyway. Again, patients who recur after getting a neoadjuvant and adjuvant Pembro are going to have a worse outcome. And you really want to optimize it as much as possible. And in patients with early relapse, I had already given off-label SG and Pembro and seen very nice and prolonged results that were, you know, not expected given their rapid progression. So I think that this will be really important and practice-changing data. We also saw a press release in the non-PD-L1 positive population, which represents, you know, 60-65% of patients with metastatic TNBC, that also showed an improvement in PFS. So this is just a more efficient, better, more effective way of delivering cytotoxic therapy, and for triple negative disease has the potential to make a big impact in our patients. And I think it gives a shot in the arm to ASCENT-05, which is looking at SG and Pembro in the post-neoadjuvant setting as a, and of course the trial with Dato and Durva has already completed accrual, that, you know, really this is going to be an important mechanism of rescue. And lastly, I think I'm not too worried about the PD-L1 you know, receipt in the early stage setting being low, because most of the patients I hope we treat in the future in the metastatic setting will be de novo metastatic disease, as I hope with our new strategies, we're going to cure more and more patients with early stage TNBC.
So speaking of sort of the Catherine study type model there, post-neoadjuvant therapy, obviously leads into the question about HER2 positive disease, and the other question I wanted to ask you, which we could spend an hour discussing as well as the ASCENT trial, was of course DB09, the first line trial of T-DXd. Again, we could easily spend an hour on that, but what are some of the key thoughts you have about that trial?
Well, so DB09, absolutely the expected data. You know, T-DXd better than T-DM1, better than the third line therapeutic options. Of course, it was going to be better in the first line setting. I think it was surprising that the T-DXd alone arm wasn't ready to be presented. So I think that will be interesting now, and that it was T-DXd with pertuzumab versus THP. There were some considerations. So one is less than 10% of patients had received pertuzumab before. So is that the reason why that arm did so much better? And that's different from a lot of the population we see, although a large number of patients in DB09 also had de novo metastatic disease. And that's even a greater, I think, chance that most of the people we treat in the metastatic setting will be de novo in the future, because we're going to cure more and more patients with early stage HER2 positive breast cancer. So that was interesting. And a small percentage of patients had received trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting, although more than 10%, which also is a little bit different from what we do in clinical practice and see. So even when you took into account who was de novo and who wasn't, regardless, the results were striking with a dramatic improvement in progression-free survival. I mean, the kind of thing we have come to expect with T-DXd in HER2-positive disease, where clearly the results are so, the differential is bigger than in non-HER2-positive, even HER2-low disease. And toxicity was quite modest. I mean, they were able to manage the ILD pretty well in terms of the rate of ILD, the mortality, 2 patients died. So we're still seeing that. It's really a reminder. You really need to monitor these patients and watch for ILD, particularly in the first year, and be quick to react so that we really reduce the number of patients who die from ILD. But overall, patients stayed on drugs. So one of the unique things about this was that, you know, patients who were on THP could drop the chemo after 6 cycles or so, whereas T-DXd, you stayed on chemo the whole time, right? And the median time people are on treatment was almost 2 years. If you had toxicity and you needed to stop, you could stop T-DXd and continue with trastuzumab, pertuzumab maintenance. And the other group were getting trastuzumab, pertuzumab maintenance. So the one group who were on T-DXd got chemo for a lot longer than the other group. So that's come up in some people's questions about whether or not that contributed to this big differential benefit that was seen with T-DXd. We know expected the benefit, but was that a contributing factor? The other thing which I think is interesting thinking about this study is when patients progressed, how many patients progressed in brain versus not, because we would expect a better outcome in patients who start with TDXD than those who started with THP. And then lastly, I think the question comes up about what to do with maintenance. In DB09, a surprisingly small number of patients who are eligible for hormone therapy got it as maintenance. We think that's standard. In the Patina control arm, we saw that patients who got endocrine therapy with HP as maintenance had a better outcome than Cleopatra. And you know, you could enhance it even more by adding Palbo, but I think that first arm is so important. So it's really an exhortation to use hormone therapy in the maintenance setting for these patients. And the question is, what are we going to do when we put TDXD first line, which I expect everybody will do as soon as they have the opportunity to treat a patient? And I think what we're going to do is treat to best response plus more, 6, 8 months, however long it's going to be. They're still doing well in a year. You're going to drop the TDXD and continue HP with endocrine therapy. You could add endocrine therapy in while on TDXD after the first, I think, 3 months. And that's something that we can do in clinical practice. But I think we are going to be exploring maintenance. And there is a trial called Demeter, which is exploring that now out of the MedSir group in Spain that we also will be participating in and have discussed a lot. And I think that that trial needs to continue to morph to use, you know, the P with the TDXD to add Palbo and to really understand whether we can capitalize on the superior efficacy of TDXD, but maximize the quality of life for our patients.
Just out of curiosity, are you sticking with Palbo in this situation, or were you open to the other CDK?
So we don't really know. We don't have data with the other CDK4/6 inhibitors yet, and Palbo was the Patina trial, so it's, you know, on a strict sense, I would use Palbo, and it's really well tolerated, so that's great. I think the other area that will affect how we use DB09 is the DB11 data and DB05. So what are all those dizzying array of numbers? DB11 used TDXD for 4 cycles, followed by THP for 4 cycles as neoadjuvant therapy, and had one arm with TDXD alone. They compared it to an anthracycline taxane-based regimen with trastuzumab, pertuzumab, which, you know, many people aren't using that anthracycline-based regimen. They have a press release showing that the sequence therapy, which I like, TDXD followed by THP, resulted in a superior PCR. We'll see that data later this year, so we have to see what it looks like. But maybe a lot of people will get TDXD preoperatively. And then DB05, which is looking at the post-neoadjuvant Catherine approach, expects also to have data by the end of the year. So it may be, again, you know, we're going to cure so many patients with this approach that we're only going to see DB09 in patients with de novo metastatic disease.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Rugo, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.